Most people live in a world that is so restricted with laws and patterns and traditions and precedents and policies that it is a natural instinct for man to seek some escape from the domination of outside circumstances. He has found in the material world that when he tries to go against prevailing policies of his time, he places himself under heavy penalties. And after a while, he accepts the domination of events. But this does not mean that in his heart and soul, he has not preserved the desire for freedom. We all have a sort of feeling that there's a wonderful world somewhere, or a wonderful time ahead, when we can do as we please, where circumstances will not curtail us, and we will not be forced eternally to conform. The psychological phase of this problem points out that a great many individuals, finding their external lives greatly restricted, attempt to escape into an internal existence which they instinctively assume to be lawless. Most persons entering into their own internal psychology feel that in this area they should be able to do as they please. They can have a private life inside themselves, which is certainly beyond the jurisdiction of material law and order. But it does not follow that the internal life of man is not under certain specific rules. It is hard for us, therefore, ever to escape a lawful state of affairs. There is one difference, of course, between the laws of the external world and those of the inner life. In the external world, laws are arbitrarily made. Many of them are essentially good. Some of them are superabundant, too confused and involved to hold our real respect or admiration. And in some way, these laws do not seem to adjust to the real needs of individuals. Laws are made for groups, and the person must always be the victim of the collective circumstances of his time. We therefore like to assume that the inner life of man is not under such arbitrary statutes. And it is true that the laws are different, but they are nevertheless constantly operating. The laws of the inner life are based upon natural law itself. These laws have never been amended or passed upon by physical legislators. They have never been subject to debate. There have never been any filibustering in this area. These laws are man's most immediate acquaintance with the great pattern of universal procedure. So man going inside of himself must trust himself to universal law, just as man on the outside must adjust himself to man-made law. Going in, therefore, into this inner area of subjective existence, man learns gradually that his emotions, his thoughts, his ideas and his opinions are all of them subject to a kind of supervision. And if he fails to guard his own character, nature begins to move in and impose various penalties upon him. In old religions, penalties were divided into two classifications. One consisted of crimes meaning the breaking of physical legislative laws and codes, and the others were called sins, which were crimes against the inner life, against God, the Spirit, and the great metaphysical structure of principles in which the individual exists and has his being. And even in old times, it was pointed out that to break a mortal law is bad. To break one of the immortal laws in space is worse, because we set in motion circumstances and conditions which we must abide by over a long period of time. Philosophic nations, therefore, early recognized the operation of the principles of cause and effect in the psychological life of man. And the Hindus created their doctrine of karma to take care of this phase of human responsibility. Karma was simply the law of cause and effect applied to the mental and emotional activity of the human being. Where planets follow planets in the sky, where great motions of universal energies occur, we think of cause and effect. Where the individual comes into some pattern of penalties due to his own conduct, this is still cause and effect, but we call it karma, because we apply it more to the moral life, to the activity of an intelligent creature. Naturally, the law of karma depends upon one factor, namely that man has the power of personal decision. If man was not capable of a moral action, if he was not capable of choosing a course of conduct by a free choice of his own conscience and his own consciousness, there could be no karma. Yet his body, nature, and all the parts of him would still be under the grand pattern of cause and effect. In philosophy, the thought has long been advanced that it would be very good for the average person to recognize the lawfulness of the processes taking part or taking place within him. In other words, if we could really come to believe that our thoughts and emotions were under a legislative control, that we were responsible for them, and that if we violate their laws, we must pay the penalty, just as surely as we must pay a fine or lose privileges if we break physical law. To recognize that this strange, scattered, confused pattern of our feelings could be under a pattern of law is a little difficult for the average person. He senses very little organization in his own inner life. He would like to have it. He knows it is possible. He believes it would be good, but he still doesn't exercise the processes which would bring it about. Consequently, as we get up in the morning, and we have all kinds of thoughts, as we go along through the day with the innumerable conflict of ideas and attitudes and opinions, and we find ourselves liking this and hating that, wishing we were somewhere else, not keeping our minds properly focused upon the things we are doing, as we drift along through the day with these rather slipshod policies, it hardly occurs to us that we're getting into trouble. Or perhaps we rather say that by the very endowments that we have, we're always in trouble, and this is just another example. Perhaps it might be, however, very good, philosophically speaking, to settle down to the simple conclusion that thoughts are things, and that thoughts and things are governed by law, that emotions must follow and obey the principles upon which they depend, and that all things must in some way be true and faithful to the source of their own nutrition, to the very vital energies that make them possible. Man then can settle down to include in his psychology of life a very simple and clear definition of the relationship between law and his own feelings, his own moods, his own attitudes. If he can do this, many things that are now complicated will straighten out. The law of cause and effect operating in nature operates in correlation with several other laws, each of which has its own part to play in the complete pattern. But for our purposes, perhaps, this law can be separated from the others, at least for the purpose of an evening's discussion. And we can bring some emphasis to bear upon an area which is of peculiar vitality at the moment. In order to get a good philosophy of life, we must do a little philosophizing about living. Without this procedure, we will not attain a clear insight into the purpose for our own existence. So we can say first that the law of cause and effect, operating from the most remote conceivable time, and in every area, level, field of existence, tells us one primary truth at the beginning, namely that everything has a purpose, that what is actually happening throughout the universe is that purpose is revealing itself, a purpose that has to exist, a purpose that has a pre-existence over all of the consequences and effects which emanate from it. Thus, law of cause and effect affirms a lawful universe in all its parts, progressing according to an immutable, unchanging plan, and that this plan affects everything from the grain of sand to the cosmos itself. There is nothing immune to law. There is nothing greater than law. There is nothing that dares to break law. Because if this law is broken, the penalty is inevitable. Now, why is this penalty inevitable? Early theologians attempted to theologize this concept. They felt that this penalty was punishment, that somewhere in the sky was an old man with a book, and in this book he wrote down everything that you did. And when finally came the judgment day, it was all read back to you, and for some people it'll be pretty lurid reading. This, however, was a rather childish approach to it. We do not believe that the finger of deity is going to point to some individual and say, "You were pretty nasty on the 6th of June." We don't believe that type of retributional process. Nor do we believe that in the universe there are judges sitting somewhere that will give out penalties of various kinds, as it is done here, sometimes justly, sometimes not justly, but according to the immediate situation or the whim of the moment. This does not seem to be right to us. Therefore, the law of cause and effect operating in our lives, we assume to be a sort of self-sustaining instrument. The individual who moves with the law moves in harmony with nature. The individual who moves contrary to law breaks his own harmonic relationship with life. The moment he breaks harmony, he breaks faith. The moment he no longer moves with the great motion of space, he is no longer carried along by that motion. When he resists it, he receives the full impact of it against himself. So that the person who breaks laws simply breaks pattern, deprives himself of the great motions which would carry him painlessly to a good destiny. Instead of obeying these principles, moving with them, he tries to move contrary to them. He violates them in some way. This violation does not cause an entry in a ledger in the sky. This violation simply causes a resistance in the patterns around him. He finds himself not supported by the universe if he breaks its rules. And if he loses this support, he loses every orientation that he possesses. Now, the average person does not break faith utterly with universal patterns because he doesn't even know how to do this. He simply makes small mistakes. These small mistakes would naturally have small penalties, and they do. These penalties are very often nothing more serious than the minor accidents of small children who are foolhardy or who lack the patience or the industry to accomplish something well. One of the ways in which man has to learn is by means of coming into occasional conflicts with natural law. He has to gradually experience his way into a constructive association with nature. Animals and all these lesser creatures, although largely dominated by instinct, also proceed by trial and error. Trial and error is a way of life which must be lived by persons who are not aware of the full rules of the game. They must attempt to do certain things, various things. And they must come into rewards which indicate they were right, or they must come into penalties which indicate they were wrong. This process is constantly going on. And within a reasonable area of normalcy, this pattern is expected by nature, is accepted, and is nature's own way of instruction. But man, unfortunately, is not always sensitive to the lessons with which nature provides him. We find individuals making the same mistakes through a long lifetime. We find that some folks just don't learn from what happens to them. These, of course, when they become on the level of human beings, not only have the advantage of the operation of law in their own lives, but they can study the operation of this law in history, in the development of arts and sciences. For in every art and science, we are in the presence of immutable laws, principles that must be obeyed if we wish to attain a certain end. If the musician does not obey the rules of harmony, he will not create great music. If the mathematician does not fulfill the laws of his science, his formulas are unsound, and arithmetic loses its meaning as an instrument in advancing life. If the chemist does not progress his experiments in a lawful manner, they will not work properly. And if he is too unlawful in his experimenting, he may blow himself and his laboratory to small fragments. He may destroy himself. Thus, everywhere, the intelligent person tries to proceed with law. But he gets tired of this lawful procedure. He gets wearied with it, and he seldom brings it home and tries to apply it to the problems of his own inner life. He does not recognize the meaning of trial and error. One of the reasons why he gets into trouble, probably, is because he tries to play God in relationship to the laws under which he lives. Man has a peculiar little superstition of his own that nature has never supported, but which man himself industriously attempts to maintain. And that is that he, in some way, has a right to vary law according to his own pleasures, his own advantages. He feels that in a mysterious manner, he can break the law. Or perhaps he feels that in some way law doesn't apply to him at all. This is true of the egotist. And one of the reasons why the egotist is always in trouble is that he is always elevating himself above the patterns which he should learn to obey. The willful person seems to feel that he can break his way through law, that laws are made for weak people, that he does not have to keep them, that he can live as he pleases, and that the universe will not too strenuously object. Thus, the willful person is to a sense, or in a sense, a kind of gangster who attempts to live according to his own code, and a very antisocial one at that. There are many persons also in this world who simply do not believe in a lawful universe. And this problem has affected us a great deal in more recent years. As our education, particularly, lost its ethics, lost its recognition of moral value, it began to preach the idea that man can do anything he wants to do, that the universe is a great blank area in which man can build his own conceits. If man wants a super industrial existence, he can have it, because there is nothing in there, in nature, except what man puts in. There are no rules that must say that a man should be good or a man should be bad. These things are at his own decision. He can live as he pleases, think as he pleases, because there is no controlling power. This, of course, is quite possible if a person is an atheist, or if he is an individual who has addicted himself to certain types of humanistic doctrines, which simply take it for granted that the universe is here for man to exploit. And the man who exploits it the most becomes the richest, most powerful, popular man, and may even attain the noble end of being the richest man in the graveyard. This end is always considered, but people pay little attention to it. They keep on living until they can't live any longer, and they make very little effort to make their lives meaningful or intelligent. So if a person doesn't believe in a universe of natural law, obviously he does not feel impelled to keep any rules that he does not have to keep. He doesn't really believe in laws in the community. He doesn't believe in speed laws. He doesn't believe in laws against crime. He has to endure them, but if he is psychologically an atheist or an anarchist, he resents law and its operation in his life. And there are many people who just hate law. They don't believe in it. They think it's terribly unjust because it interferes with the right of anyone and everyone to do exactly as he pleases. Because of our modern viewpoint, this situation is getting into mental institutions as a source of trouble. It is affecting the viewpoint not only of the patient, but of the physician. If the physician does not believe that he lives in a lawful universe, he cannot impress this upon his patient, nor can he use the principles of law to assist in therapy. He then becomes an individual doing anything he can think of to help somebody else who is in trouble. This is not what you might term a well-organized program, and it cannot produce the maximum results for all concerned. If we are rather more serious than this, however, it would be very good if we could simply settle down sometime and sell ourselves a basic idea. And when I mean sell ourselves, I don't mean talk ourselves into a mental concept. I mean get so thoroughly imbued with an idea that it can never leave you again, and also that it can never let you alone if you go contrary to it. If we could finally reach a point where we could actually and honestly and honorably feel to the very core of ourselves that we do live under law, and that the only way we can be happy is to keep the law, if we really believed this, we would not only change our inner lives tremendously, but probably very largely change the entire social problem of crime. Because crime is an expression of something. It does not arise spontaneously. It comes from a psychology of life that is bad, for one reason or another. The person who has the proper sense of responsibility and who has well-established ideals and principles does not normally become a criminal. He might, under great excess, be an occasional criminal. But crime, as we know it, would be reduced almost to the vanishing point. If persons believed not merely in the power of physical law or material law, but in the inevitability of legal process in consciousness, that it's there inside, governing us, directing us, and demanding certain things from us at all times. If we live with a sense of lawfulness inside of ourselves, then we could begin the serious program of self-integration. We would not require constant counseling. We would not require the untangling of the complicated threads of our psychic lives. We would know almost certainly how to conduct ourselves at all times. So let us assume for a moment that we are interested in psychology as an instrument of self-improvement, and therefore that we are interested in trying to put the psychic life into a little better regulated condition. Then let us begin by things we have pointed out before, but we almost have to mention them again to fit them into the picture. One of the first and most important conclusions that we can come to in connection with this idea of a lawful way of life is that every thought and emotion, every instinct and impulse must have an effect in us. That this effect must be exactly according to its cause. That it cannot be contrary. And that we cannot justify at any time an action that is contrary to the law of cause and effect. Furthermore, we can never, by argument or debate or interpretation, make a poor cause good, any more than we can in any way detract from the dignity of a good cause. We often try to assume that there are modifying circumstances by means of which we should be forgiven the common and ordinary mistakes that we should never make. You'll hear an individual say, "I know I should have kept my temper under those circumstances, but I just didn't." But of course, I had a tremendous amount of provocation, and therefore this provocation should seemingly justify this emotional intemperance. If the circumstances are bad enough, it is therefore right for us to do wrong. This is common thinking. If the temptation is great enough, it is the temptation that is to blame and not ourselves. If we have certain attitudes, and these attitudes are not good, they're our own private business, and people can either like it or not like it. That's up to them. We will continue on our present course. I've heard people say many times that they admitted that they had defects of character that were very real, but they'd always had them, and their parents had had them, and their friends have got them, so they're just going to keep them. And they don't see any reason why they should be blamed for having them, especially by other people who aren't any better. This becomes a very definite feeling. I agree with these folks. They should not be blamed by other people who have the same mistakes. But they are going to be punished by nature that makes no mistakes. And there is nothing they can do about it. We perhaps should definitely follow the ancient idea that it is not up to us to judge anything. But nature itself judges righteous judgment. And before the court of nature, all the facts are considered. And all the evasions are regarded just as they are in a court of physical law, where it is affirmed again and again that ignorance is no excuse in the face of the law. Now, ignorance may be an excuse to some degree in the face of natural law because we do not understand it. We try to, but we're not able always. But normally speaking, the individual is responsible when he performs an action or thinks a thought or feels an emotion which he himself knows is not right. Now, how is he going to know that it's not right? Well, one group falls back upon Kant's great categorical imperative, which was a philosophical concept made to correct the mistakes in the Golden Rule. This categorical imperative simply states that when you want to know whether an action that you performed is right or not, you should simply say to yourself, if everyone else on earth did exactly the same thing, would we have a happy world? That's your final imperative. In other words, when you measure your own conduct and perform any action, think any thought or feel any emotion, would you be glad if all your relatives did it to you at the same moment? Would you be happy if it became the law of the land? Would you rejoice if your business competitor did it? Would you be completely pleased about the whole thing if your children grew up and did it to you? If you can't say yes to this, then according to the imperative, you are wrong. You are wrong to do it yourself, or permit yourself to do it. This is one way in which we can judge some of these matters. Now, aesthetics has another rule to apply to this problem. How to judge whether what we do is right or not. Aesthetics says, is it beautiful? Is the thing we are doing truly noble? Has it about it a graciousness that would permit it to endure as a work of art? In other words, would we like to see a magnificent tapestry of how we felt on Tuesday morning? Or would we turn it to the wall and hope never to see it again? In our same concept, would we like to have this particular thing we have done accepted as a true statement of ourselves? Would we want our friends and our neighbors and other people to judge us by this action alone? Would we want our children to think of us in the terms of the attitude we took on this particular subject? Chances are we wouldn't want them to. We would want them to be patient with us, even as we are patient with them. And we will explain to them that when they grow up, they will have provocations just like what we had on Tuesday morning. And we can only hope they will do better than we have done, but we doubt it. Now, this type of thinking is entirely on our own. It has no relationship to values. It has no relationship to the principles upon which life is founded. Another level on which we can judge this particular attitude that we hold is, does it produce an immediate constructive effect? Here your law of cause and effect comes in. Now, some people think that some of the things they do badly produce magnificent effects, just exactly the ones they want. They decide that they're going to insult someone. That person is properly insulted and walks away in a huff. And the person who did it is just tickled to death. That is exactly what they wanted. They wanted to give this person a piece of their mind. So they gave them a piece of their notions instead, but they thought it was their mind. And they are very smugly satisfied about the whole procedure. Some people just seemingly have to criticize or condemn something, or the day is a dismal failure. But does this, in turn, actually achieve any enrichment of life? What is it satisfying? It is satisfying that part of our natures which is largely responsible for the troubles we're in. Consequently, as we give power or authority to these negative instincts in ourselves, we gradually lose more and more control over our own thoughts and emotions, and can well be on the way to psychotic trouble. Some psychologists take the position that the average person, being somewhat neurotic anyway, there is nothing better for him than a good temper fit. If he gets good and mad at something and sort of explodes, he's going to feel a lot better. I doubt this very much. I don't believe that a temper fit is a solution to anything. It is merely, perhaps, a letting off of a little steam. But it is letting it off in a violent way, like an earthquake which lets off a little steam or takes care of a shift in the Earth's surface, but which certainly cannot be regarded as especially helpful as an event. The person who has to let off steam in order to be happy simply doesn't know what to do with steam in the first place, or he would know that it was created to drive an engine or for some noble purpose besides an explosion. The person, therefore, who has to be temperamentally unbalanced in order to regain his composure is just wrong and in trouble already. The problem, then, of letting these negative attitudes take over is one of condoning. Even in our physical way of life, we condone today many things that we should not accept. We condone them because others do, because there doesn't seem to be much we can do about them, and they some way seem to contribute to getting along, but we do not know just how. But this problem of condoning things that are wrong does not work out in our inner lives any better than it does in our material affairs. Live by a code of compromise and you will ultimately come to grief. This is an experience that all persons have to go through at some time in their long evolutionary careers. The answer then is obviously one of trying to recognize the relationship between cause and effect in action. Some years ago, the rise of the psychosomatic theory clearly pointed out the relationship between human feelings and thoughts and health. And we came to some findings that were pretty important and pretty real as far as their value in our daily life is concerned. Perhaps some of the very ancient peoples were wiser than we have ever given them credit for being, in their contention that nearly all sickness was sent by the gods in punishment for error. We have this theory that sickness, which we couldn't explain any other way, particularly in primitive society, when no one knew really what sickness was or how it came, the answer was that God sent it. That it came as a punishment for something. And for thousands of years, we've been trying to figure out just what it was punishment for. And a lot of people felt it was very unfair, and they resented the punishment tremendously. Perhaps under this thought of the psychology of it, this idea that sickness came from the gods, or was a punishment for the breaking of the divine rules, has a kind of truth in it. We don't believe in the old Olympian despots anymore, ruling the world from their cloud-swept palaces. But perhaps sickness in some way is a punishment sent by the law, an outworking of the universal principles governing human conduct. Psychosomatics certainly indicated a good structure of evidence in this direction. The fact also still does remain in society that happy people, cheerful people, kindly people, seemingly have better luck with help, if we may call it luck, than those of other temperaments. People whose dispositions are bad are usually unhealthy. They are usually crippled by ailments of one kind or another. And if these ailments are not of the body, they are of the mental and emotional structure itself. And persons who break the laws governing the use of thought and emotion are almost obviously penalized. We can almost see it happen in their daily affairs. We know that persons with attitudes which are unfriendly simply end up without friends. This is cause and effect. Now, these people have entirely different explanations for it. The less friendly others are, the more these individuals feel themselves to be the victims of injustice. So that in most instances, what we call injustice is just law and order coming back to us where we don't want it. We think that injustice is when we are required to pay our bills. Justice is when other people pay their bills. It is perfectly just for other people to be good to us. But it isn't always just in our minds for us to be good to other people. These laws that do not work both ways have no place in a natural pattern. The Chinese pointed that out. Unless the law operates both ways, it is not fair or right and will not produce the constructive results that we want. The Buddhist numbered 106 faults from which man can suffer. I think they were very moderate in their listing, but the average person does not have any idea of 106 categories working in his own nature against him. But practically every attitude that the average person holds is at least subject to improvement if he wants to improve it. But there are a whole chain of negative reactions, conscious and instinctive, which as long as they are tolerated or endured, will conspire against the well-being of the person. And as these policies that are not good are allowed to encroach upon the total psychic life of the person, he becomes less and less aware of them, until in the end, he is completely fooled by himself. He is deceived by his own attitude so completely that he has no conscientious desire to change or mend them. So let's try and see how this law of cause and effect works out in the moral pattern of human society as far as the inner conduct of man is concerned. Suppose we say that there are a group of these negative attitudes. We mostly know them by name, and the names do not cause any great admiration. For instance, take jealousy. Jealousy is a very strange and mixed emotion. It rises in us very often without our control or direction. And again, a group of persons have made a virtue of it. Some people think they're neglected unless someone is jealous of them. I've heard a good many young families in which the wife has stated definitely that if her husband wasn't jealous of her, she'd leave him. There's a pleasant thought. In most cases, he obliged, I think. But then, after a while, if this kept up, he might have had to work pretty hard to oblige. But many people think, unless others are jealous of them or possessive of them, that they are indifferent. And this situation causes jealousy under certain conditions to be regarded as a serious offense. Under others, as something practically entitled to receive the crown of martyrdom. It all depends upon the circumstances. But nature says no. Jealousy as an emotion is wrong. Jealousy is the perversion of an emotion. All perversion is wrong. just as surely as a man thinks. So he can worry. And worry is a misuse of mental energy. Now, there can be thousands of reasons why we worry. But if we worry, we break the law. Now, this is pretty stiff thinking, and it would make an awful lot of lawbreakers. But the fact remains that nature expects us to worry a little. Nature has supplied us with some very special materials in the form of endocrine secretions, which we can call upon in turn of worry. It also has provided us with natural secretions to call upon when we become afraid, which is another negative emotion. Nature knows that we're going to fall under these pressures sometimes and to some degree. And there are probably a half a dozen times in the life of the average person where it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for an individual with our allotment of understanding not to worry. But these incidents do not constitute the chronic worrier. The chronic worrier has long ago used up all natural defense. He has exhausted all natural support that might come to him in time of emergency, just as the coward has used up all of his fear resources. He is simply an excessive example of a negative attitude. So the worrier who worries about everything is a lawbreaker. He is going into a negative relationship with himself, which breaks the basic laws of mind. He is going into negative relationships with other people. He is creating a minus quantity in his own psyche. He's creating negative habits with which he must later live. And if he worries long enough, he will have plenty to worry about. Nature will take care of providing him if he insists on developing that faculty. And he will ultimately come to grief, because worry will produce a gradual disorientation of his psychic nature and degeneration of his physical resources. He is just not permitted to get away with it. And you can say this for every type of attitude you have. Now, the same is true in what we call basic constitutional attitudes. Most persons are born with a disposition which other people wish they didn't have. But we don't seem to know much about what to do about it. We are born with prevailing tempers and tendencies. Some people become emotional easily. Others are quiet regardless of pressure or circumstances. Some hold grudges naturally, others just do not. Some become tremendously excited over small matters. Others do not rise to these occasions at all. There are all kinds of basic temperaments. And these different temperaments are largely differentiated according to their dominant excesses. A temperament that is particularly tempestuous, we may call a choleric disposition, a fiery nature. And the ancients recognized four natures: fiery, earthy, airy, and watery, corresponding to the elements. And the earthy nature was the one that was always somber and a little bit on the sad side of things, and gradually ran into very materialistic fears about its own survival. The watery nature was the one in which there was a great deal of vacillation of temperament. The currents of life were constantly moving and the individual lacked stability. The fiery temperament was tempestuous and elemental, as the fire itself suggests. The airy disposition was the intellectual, rather whimsical nature, in which everything was touched with a certain breeze or lightness, but which under some conditions could turn into a terrible storm. So these temperaments were recognized. And as we are born with them of these factors, we grow up with them from childhood. and accept them to be natural and normal and quite reasonable. In fact, they are no longer temperaments, they are ourselves. We are these things. And because we are these, we do not think of changing them or really desiring to particularly. We assume that they are proper because they are us. They are our own natures. But if any of these patterns are not good, they are still going to lead into trouble. And as the psychological situation gets more extreme every day, we have to begin to work a little with some of these problems. And we're going to have to work with them in the near future and in the years that lie ahead. Because at the present time, great strain is being placed upon our integration by world affairs. The average person today is being tested more than he realizes by the circumstances around him. He has many opportunities for fear. He has many opportunities for worry. And he has quite a few opportunities for hatred. We are finding it very easy to escape from the small degree of control that we had over ourselves in comparatively placid times. So we are being tried. We are being weighed in the balance. And a lot of people are being found wanting. In fact, most people are found wanting something, if the truth were known. But actually, we are found without an adequate amount of internal resource. We are found becoming panic-stricken, worrying about things excessively. And in this worrying state, we almost feel a little patriotic. If we really can get ourselves into a stew about something, we are taking a serious interest in life. If we come up with conclusions that are no good but indicate a tremendous amount of intensity, we are supposed to be thoughtful people. But this strain that is coming to us is going to reflect in our psychology of life over many years that lie ahead. And either man must meet strain with internal integration and growth, or he will break under that strain. And society as a collective will fall back into savagery simply because it is unable to stand the pressure of conditions upon an immature internal life. Nature sometimes has to play it that way. Nature has its end, and that end is one and one end only, namely that man shall fulfill the purpose for which he was created. And as far as we can tell, we don't know the ultimates of these things, but as far as we can tell, the purpose of man is to unfold the tremendous power within himself and become truly aware as a conscious being of the reason for his own existence, the purposes for which he was fashioned, the laws governing him, and the nature of the great universe of consciousness with which he shares through the conscious parts of his own faculties. In other words, man is to grow infinitely and indefinitely towards a magnificent achievement, which is a complete integration of his entire consciousness. Perhaps if he achieves this end, he shall truly be like the gods, knowing good and evil. But in any event, nature is trying to perfect him, to make him every day better, wiser, nobler, stronger in real values. And nature keeps on pressing this point relentlessly. And nature punishes every individual or every process which would hamper, restrict, limit, or delay this achievement. And is constantly observant of these processes. Allowing man his trial and error procedure, nature still demands that he learn something. That this trial and error shall not be a continuous cycle of accidents, all meaningless, but that gradually the individual will learn what he shall do and what he shall not do. And the wise man, having learned these things, does what he should do. Nature's plan is just that simple. Yet its very simplicity baffles us and outrages us because of the innumerable personal attitudes we are capable of holding and which we feel that we have a perfect right to exercise at any time. In the study of man's integration, we know that man can be subject to two evils, and that these two evils, as Pythagoras pointed out 2,600 years ago, are the evils of excess. Now, excess is either superabundance or deprivation. Excess is imbalance, always. That which is too much is unbalanced. That which is too little is unbalanced. A man who has too much is a plutocrat, and his problems are according to his possession. The man who has too little is unable to provide his natural needs or to live in proper dignity with other human beings. So these excesses represent causes, continuous causes of trouble. Now, in man, excess is nearly always present. He measures his emotions in terms of their excesses. When he is happy, he is very optimistic. When he is unhappy, he is very miserable. And he alternates between these polarities continuously. When he is virtuous, he is just overloaded with it until it becomes almost intolerable. When he lacks it, he becomes a scoundrel that no one can admire. He has lost the golden mean, the concept of moderation. Wherever there is an excess in our nature, it will lead us into excessive action. And nature does not function by excess. Excess itself is wrong, because nature realizes that excess always leads to a tangent, that an excessive situation always forces the possessor of it into a conflict with life. And this conflict of life means that he will ultimately be tossed back into the stream of life, wounded and bruised by the experience. Therefore, the person who has any excess in his nature must first begin to achieve moderation. What he cannot control completely, what he cannot prevent entirely, what he cannot dominate wholly, he brings into line through moderation. If he must worry, he will worry moderately. If he must be jealous, he will be very moderate at it. If he is to be selfish, he will be very moderate in his selfishness. He will gradually work away from excess toward the Socratic mean. He will find gradually that as he moderates these pressures, their insistences diminish also. And after a period of moderation, further moderation is easy. But from a stage of excess to one of complete control is a terribly difficult and almost dangerous step. So wherever there is trouble in our nature, our first problem is to reduce the trouble, to make it less continuously, by exercising gradually greater wisdom and understanding over the situation that may arise. One of the old habits, of course, practices was that in these pressureful moments, pause and consider. Our forefathers advised everyone to count 10. Well, sometimes today you haven't got quite time for 10, but you can count 5 and see if it won't help.